Welcome, everyone, and we hope you enjoy today's conversation with another imperfect leader, those rare human beings willing to be totally vulnerable, willing to share amazing stories of personal growth, and ready to inspire a future generation of leaders across the entire world. No doubt about it, Pixar is one of the most creative brands in the entire world. For nearly 30 years, Pixar's made movies that make us all laugh, cry, wonder, stretch our imagination, and feel the full range of human emotion. Today's guest, Ed Catmull, has a totally unique perspective on Pixar. He should. After all, he's the guy who helped start this company from scratch, and then he was the force who built it into a creative powerhouse. During this amazing journey, a hero's journey, he worked side by side with icons like Steve Jobs, George Lucas, and more recently with Bob Iger at Disney. But unlike some of his contemporaries, Ed is most comfortable working behind the scenes, out of the spotlight, working hard and thoughtfully to create a culture that helps other people succeed and help creative talent reach their full human potential. So here we are, honored to have Ed Catmull on today's show. Let's jump right in and start with his relationship with none other than Steve Jobs. You're an idol of mine. You have one of the most impressive resumes of anyone on earth. And we're going to get to that in a minute. But first, let me start with one guy in particular in your old Rolodex, Steve Jobs. You work side by side with him longer than anyone else ever has. And I mean, many, many decades. So let's just start with what was this guy like?
Well, I first met him because we were at Lucasfilm, and he was in the process of being pushed out of Apple. So once he was out, which is a public humiliation, obviously, he then met with us, and he wanted to buy Pixar from Lucasfilm in order to make a new computer company. And it was clear that he wanted to make a computer company to compete with Apple, so we turned him down. But a year later, by accident, I ran into Steve at the Computer Graphics Conference in San Francisco. And he said, "Ed, how's it going?" And I said, "Well, it's not going very well." But now he wanted to talk about buying Pixar from Lucasfilm, except now he was willing to do it on aligned with what we wanted to do, which is based upon computer graphics. So we went through a process which led to him acquiring us. I knew the reputation of Steve. Mm-hmm. And when he acquired us, there was one interesting incident that took place on the day the deal closed. He put his arms around Alvy and me, and he said, "Whatever happens, we have to be loyal to each other." Now, I remember that because one was, I felt like part of this was he'd been pushed out of Apple and they were not loyal. So there was a part of it. But the other one was, I remembered it because when we actually got to the point of real stress, and we did, then we reached a point several times in which any VC or any other company would have given up on us. So I remember that comment that he made. But I would say that as we started off, the kind of behavior that he had, and I thought at the time that he really doesn't understand empathy and the way he talked with people. And it wasn't actually that he was mean about it. Like, he didn't seem to understand certain things. And at that time, I thought, I don't know if people can change in that way. Mm-hmm. So that was the way it was at the beginning. And then what I saw at Next was that in terms of his decisions, he made some questionable hardware decisions. And he made what I thought were a few very poor business decisions because he thought some of these things he did were home runs. When I looked at it, I said, "That's not a home run. That's actually what looks like a home run right now, but actually doesn't serve your long-term interest." Hmm. it was puzzling to me that he would do that.
How did he respond when you told him that?
Because it was in retrospect that I told him. Like, first of all, I wasn't confident enough at the time to say that's a stupid thing to do. But it was after I said that, okay, honestly, that didn't make any sense. He said, yeah, you're right. It was the wrong thing to do. So what they said to me was that he was thinking about what he did and he was learning from it. And in this particular case, because I would say the third thing is, class of things was, he made some brilliant software decisions. He got Berkeley, BSD, Unix, and they built on it, and they built Next Step on top of it. So it's to start from some software that already had a wide base of tools and connections for the internet, mm-hmm. and then built Next Step to make it more accessible. Mm-hmm. So all this brilliant, brilliant team. So those are the categories of the decisions. Mm-hmm. So on the home run side, on the financial was, he got IBM to put $100 million they bought the license to Next Step for $100 million. So home run, that's a lot of money for this little company, except that IBM didn't have rights to subsequent versions of Next Step. Mm. It's like he negotiated a really good deal, he thought, but if they don't have the rights to subsequent versions, you can't make it a standard. Now, I don't know what moron at IBM thought this was a good idea either. I was like, who in the world thought this is going to work? But when I talked with Steve about it later, he says, yeah, that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. But he was learning from it. Mm-hmm. So what I found was that there was that behavior and he was slowly learning. And I'd also say he didn't have a sense of humor when he started. But there was that period between 91 and 95 in which Steve went through a fairly radical transformation. And in 91 was when his son got, where was his son Reed was born, he got married, and we started on Toy Story. And in 95, we went public at the end of the year. And it was the first real financial success Steve had had since he left Apple. Hmm. So you put all those things together. And what it really amounts to is it's like the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. You're cast out, you make some mistakes along the way, but the mistakes inform how you grow and what you learn. Mm-hmm. And at this point, all those things came together. And after Steve went through this transformation, the people who are with him stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Well, in what? How would you describe the transformation? I mean, did he develop more empathy over this time? Did he develop more of a sense of humor? Did his business judgment become more clear and sound? I mean, how would you describe his evolution as a leader?
In terms of the humor, for me, one of the best symbols of it was at one of his shows for when he returned to Apple and Apple was now taking off, and he's got his, you know, his annual thing where he comes out and presents the new product. And so there's this presentation. And as he comes out onto the stage, then you can hear people start to laugh. And over the next few minutes, more and more people are laughing as they realize that it's not Steve. It's Noah Wyle, the actor.
Yeah.
Now, Noah Wyle was on a series on television in which he portrayed Steve in the negative sense from the early years of Steve's life. So, and Steve knew, well, okay, he's an actor. He's not the one that wrote the story. So to bring him on the stage to portray him was a great act of humor and levity.
And self-deprecating humor on top of that, right?
Yes. That was part of his change. And in terms of the empathy, he now understood fully his impact on other people. And there are times, for instance, when he would say things in meetings at Pixar to directors, because when he would say things, he would recognize that some directors would take this as almost like a gut punch. And if they were shaking too much, he would say, let's go for a walk. He was so smart that he was paying attention to what he was doing and what the effect was. And the other one, which is a harder thing for people to understand, is that he was trying to get to the truth. That means you do things to get to the truth, but he was always focused on the problem. And if you're focused on the problem and not on you being the one that's right, then you have a different kind of relationship. But it also means that you need people who likewise know how to interact with you. I mean, I'll give one example, and that was for 10 years, Pixar was a public company. And Steve fired two members of the board of directors. And the reason he fired them was they weren't pushing back. He said, if they only agree with me, they're really not adding to the conversation. So that's not the way, most leaders think. But Steve did think that way. And what it meant on the other side was he needed people who knew how to push back with him, because Steve has such a powerful personality that it takes certain kind of people to understand that's the way he thinks and not take it personally.
When you say know how to interact with Steve, does that mean you have great intellect, great experience, and courage? Or is there some other like process orientation to it?
Well, I think in the case, and I'm not Apple, of course, but I know in the case of the iPhone, ahead of time, Steve did something which was unusual. And he said, our business model is reaching the end of what we can do with laptops and desktops. And since that business model has to change, we need to switch over to something else, something portable. He then went to the executives in the company, both technical and on the marketing side. And in that discussion, Steve thought that the iPad would be the next thing. And they thought it should be the phone. So they had these intense discussions. And because he had strong people there, then they went to the phone instead of the iPad. And Steve went all in on that. Mm-hmm. So that meant that there are people there who pushed back on him to overcome his objections. And then later there was another discussion about whether or not you have an open store for the apps. And as you know, when he announced it, he wanted all inside. Mm-hmm. And the people in Apple had disagreed with him, but this time he prevailed. And then it was only out a few months in which he realized, oh, they were right and he was wrong.
So that realization that he was wrong ultimately led to a $3 trillion market cap of what the company is today, because had it been a closed app system, it would have never gotten that big.
Yeah. And the thing that people miss about this is that these discussions took place because there were people there who did disagree with him. They didn't always prevail, but they knew how to disagree. And he could listen to the arguments and he was willing to do that. And he wanted people who would push back. Mm-hmm. And this is what he was doing. He would, he would give his opinions and he expected people to push back. And, there's one, it was like this funny incident at Pixar once. And because at the time in the early days, there's widescreen television. But widescreen television, if you put it on a TV monitor, it's got either black bars at the top, you clip it off. Artistically, people want the widescreen. Disney wanted us not to have widescreen, so there was an argument about it. And Steve thought that Disney's marketing was correct. So one day, Steve is being shown around the different departments, and he goes into one meeting. And in this meeting, he saw a widescreen they're working on. So he says, why in the hell are we doing this? It's going to affect the marketing. And so the head of the artistic design, is actually the production designer for the movie, got really passionate and started to argue with Steve about it. So he and Steve had this very strong argument. And then at some point says, okay, well, let's go on to the next thing. So Steve left with the group And the production designer came up to me and says, he's almost panicked. He says, "Oh my God, I'm just arguing with Steve. Did I really screw things up?" And I said, "No, you actually won the argument." And he didn't know that, because what Steve wanted to know was, did he really care? And that was the important thing to him. Well, that's a more sophisticated thing, way of looking at things, is you have people around to push back, and you have to have people who want to care about doing the right thing. And typically, you know, mature people know they can't win everything. In fact, they probably shouldn't win everything. But if you've got to focus on doing the right thing and not on being right, and you understand that, then you end up in a better place. And at Pixar, he never really pretended to be a filmmaker. It was interesting because, and even when it came to the marketing of the films, you know, he had his own opinions about it, but he never acted as if he knew more than people who had actually been in the field. And what I've heard is, like, he was at Apple because he knows more about that world, and it was in his DNA. Then what they said is his behavior was a little bit different. But nevertheless, they loved the passion and respect that he had, and that's what he was looking for in people.
Do you ever, so of all those decades working with Steve, did you ever get in a fight with him or an argument with him?
Well, we disagreed fairly often, but I had a different style even from the others. And Steve knew that, so he just respected that my way of working was different. It was different. And part of it was, I knew immediately that there's no way that I could think as fast as he could. So getting an argument was like a really stupid thing to do. But I also saw people try to game him and prepare information so they could lead him to the right conclusion. Okay, Steve is way too smart. In fact, anybody that tries to do that is like, already they're not smart enough to realize that you can't guide him in that way. Yeah. So what I would do is I would, if I disagreed, and I should say, incidentally, the fact that somebody has a powerful personality or they're in a position of power does not mean they're right. For me, I've always been clear about that. It's like, okay, Steve may feel strongly about something, but it doesn't mean he's right. So if we disagreed, then, and I couldn't respond as fast, so I said, well, let me get back to you. And so I might take a week to think about what the next sentence is, and then he would shoot it down. So this would, these kind of conversations might go on for weeks and a few times for months. And there were three different outcomes, maybe equally likely. One of them is we just reach the point where I would realize that actually he was right. Mm-hmm. And I just say, oh, I got it. That's the end of the conversation. And another third of the time, he would say to me, oh, I get what you're saying. So that's the end. And the other third of the time, we didn't reach a conclusion. And I would just do what I wanted to do. And Steve was completely fine with that because we had discussed it. It may have been a long discussion, but we discussed it. And then I do whatever I wanted.
I love it. So Pixar, I'm a middle-aged white guy with pretty thick skin, and I cried like a little baby watching some of the movies that you guys made at Pixar. I mean, an animated robot who collected trash, and an old man that made a hot air balloon out of his house, and a rat who became a top chef. Tell me a little bit more about the kind of culture you created at Pixar that allowed creative talent to reach their full potential, because I really think that culture is at the heart of this.
Culture is at the heart of it, and at every level of the company. And I would say, even before we started Pixar, I was in what I thought was great positions. I could visit a lot of companies now, not as an analyst, but as someone that was invited in because I was at Lucasfilm, and the executives wanted to make a sale of Lucasfilm, a sexy company, and they need more compute power. But because I have a technical background, I can have lunch or dinner with the engineers. So I was essentially seeing two different pictures in the same day of each of these companies. So that, like, that was a great education. I also could recognize in some of these companies that there was a class structure, that there were people who were more important to the company than others. And so, well, that can't be good. It can't be a good way of thinking. So as we began to bring in our artists, starting at Lucasfilm, then I really wanted them to feel like they were peers with the technical people, and that's the way they should think about each other. And as we then started to make our first film, we were bringing in several artists. That's when we brought in Andrew Stanton and Pete Docter. It was always to have it set it up so that they're really peers with the others. And I'm not saying everybody's the same within group. It's just that groups need to have full respect for others. So the question is, how do you do that? How do you maintain that kind of culture where people value what other people bring? And it honestly wasn't always successful. Sometimes we had problems with it, like sort of class notion creeping in, but when we found that we could address it. But when it came to the stories, we were, I'd say, you know, somewhat lucky that first group came together, and they were pretty remarkable. And John was bringing in people who were very strong, and he didn't feel threatened by them. You know, sometimes if you bring in really strong people, some leaders might feel threatened by them, but that wasn't the start of what we had. And this group was able to have intense discussions with each other. And when you watch it, you see, even if their voices are raised, it's always raised about the problem. So at each one of these levels, it's how do we get people to care about the right thing? On the technical side, when we went to the SIGGRAPH conference, which is the computer graphics conference, then for all those early years, you wanted people to get, really like the new technology, that you'd show up as better and neater pictures. You got this wow, this high from impressing people with your technology. But I would say that everybody, all the technical people at Pixar, knew this was not what our first movie was about. The first movie, which was obviously Toy Story, would only be successful if it wasn't about the technology. So when the movie came out, then the technology people were thrilled, as I was, that with almost every review, there was only one or two lines about that it was new technology, and the rest of it was about the movie, to impact people with it. And that's what good storytelling is. And you want to have a good impact on people. And so that became like the core value they could build around, is what are we doing in the world? What's our effect? And then how do we behave inside that actually matches the value that, you know, sounds great on the outside, but how do we act inside? We actually did have an extremely strong technical group. This group was bonding together, and all of them, the technical and the artistic side, had each other's backs. So there was a relationship in place that we can build on. So when you get to the point where we're doing a film, they're not strangers to each other. So you could say, well, we were lucky to get these people together, and we were. At the same time, there was already some things we put in place as we were growing in terms of how we thought about people and how we treated people. And within that beginning seed culture, these people could not only work together, but then they could say, we like this. How do we get better at the culture? How do we grow from where we are? Because we're pretty small, as we bring in new people. And so it's like all these things are intertwined with each other. The seeds put in place, the supporting ideas that came from other places, and recognizing that the value of those.
And you talked about the core values that you implemented right away. And that is a mutual respect, you know, among artists and storytellers and the technical side.
I have to say that, you know, over the years, like at Pixar, what I realized that was that when we went into meetings to solve hard problems, the people in that meeting weren't looking at me or Jim Morris, my successor there, to say, okay, what do you want to do? What are you going to do? They talked as if they owned the problem, because, and it was the fact that they owned the problem, it gave me this a real feeling of warmth. Like it was the strongest feelings, rewarding feelings that I had all the time there, more than the awards or anything else, just in terms of personal feeling, the fact that they were owning it. And what that meant was if I'm missing things, that basically it's saying it really is these other people who are solving the problems, and it's just acknowledging it. And they know that I know that they're good. So like that's a really good thing. I don't know why people wouldn't want more of that.
Give me an example of that. What's an example of a tough problem that you guys had to solve?
You know, if we look at the evolution of the brain trust as an example. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was an evolution.
Okay.
So,
and by the way, I'm fascinated by the brain trust. So give us a little description of what that is and then the evolution of it.
Okay, so because I'd written about it, then it's got some notoriety, but it's a group that gets together on a certain things. Like when we screen a film, we'll do 7 to 9 screenings of a film along the way of our making it, so each time trying to improve it. At those points, the brain trust will come together. It consists of these people who are brilliant at solving problems. Mm-hmm.
And these people are other directors and other filmmakers that are not part of the film being made, but are there to give feedback and input and constructive criticism.
Yes, that's right. Okay. So it's got the creative leadership on the film and then other people who've been through the process in other films. So, but it didn't start from day one. It evolved. And so the question is, how did it evolve?
How did it start?
Well, the way it started was when we made our first couple of films, we were under contract with Disney, and the president of Disney Animation at the time was Tom Schumacher. And Tom is rather remarkable because he gave very good feedback and he wanted us to succeed. We would go down with the film, show them, and he would give us really good guidance and help. But because he was only seeing it occasionally, he wasn't lost in the movie. He could be objective while at the same time being very knowledgeable about what we're doing. So our interests are aligned. And so as we were making these first few films, we had him as sort of that as an outside force. I mean, the way I would term it, it's like an outside force that you want to line up with what you're doing. You don't get many of those, but he was one for us. But we were also reaching a point where we were becoming more successful than Disney, and Tom Schumacher was being moved back to run the musical theatricals in New York City. So we were going to lose this outside force. So the question is, who's going to do it? So Andrew suggested that we have this particular group of people that was so strong, you know, starting with Toy Story, that as we started other projects and brought in new directors, that this group would become the Brain Trust. And he's the one that came up with the name. So now the thing, yeah, I understand. I'm sorry. I know the story too well, so I will sometimes leave off names.
That's why I'm here.
Yes, yeah, so sometimes I'll even put in the wrong name. But the real point was that the confidence for him to say, this is what we should do. And or John might say we should do this. Somebody else will say we should do it because they all care. And what that meant was that the building and the evolution of this was not something that I was doing, but we had a culture in which other people could do it. So they really were all owning it.
But other people could do it and other people wanted to do it.
Yes. Now, the thing is, if you have the right kind of environment, they're not actually questioning their right to be able to suggest things. Mm-hmm. But they're also not interested in things other than being making good films or other things or even like that. So they're just interested in helping others grow and do the right thing. So all along, there's this, it's a supporting thing for each other.
And just real quickly, Ed, from your background and, you know, knowledge of the industry, is this common among directors, or is there more competition, you know, between directors wanting to come out on top?
Well, you know, it varies. If you actually look at the feature film world, the way it typically works is the directors and the producers and a lot of the talent are actually independent and they know each other, but they don't work for the studios. So the studios do the marketing, they'll gather things together. But when they're going to make a film, they'll hire a writer, then they'll bring in the directors. It's a different story for each one. But the point is, it's like almost like a gig economy. Mm-hmm. They assemble them. But one of the difficulties is that they don't have a culture for any company. Instead, there's a culture in LA. And some of these people are supportive, but they don't really own each other's film. They don't feel personal ownership. So a director may or may not ask for feedback. But also for a lot of directors, one of their goals is to get to the point where they don't have to take the feedback from the suits of the studios. Now, the people of the studios might actually be very good. They're the ones that are judged by whether or not a film does well. But the directors often don't want the feedback from people they think aren't filmmakers. So it's not, I would say it's not highly functional. A somewhat different way of working is these series on television where there's a showrunner and there's some continuity. So you've got a group of people creatively follow through for the series. And the culture within those just depends upon who that showrunner is. Some of them being run very well and some are nightmares.
So you guys have this brain trust and Tom leaves and Andrew and others are now part of this this brain trust. So then how does it evolve and how does it work and how are the directors responding to it?
The intent is very clear. Then it is thought of right at the beginning as a way of getting help. And the other thing, and the reason for saying something about Hollywood is, in this case, everybody works together. And therefore, their success is actually going to accrue to somebody that follows, and everybody understands this. That is, if I do a good job, it's going to help because our name gets better. And if you think about it, and you see a film, you may not know whether it's Sony or Warner's, but you do know if it's made from like from Pixar, because mm-hmm. it has some meaning. But they now know that, so they have a motivation to help each other, even though they're not on the film, mm-hmm. because they're going to be in the other position later on. So the idea was this brain trust was going to be the outside force. Mm-hmm. It didn't work.
Why?
It didn't work because they saw the film so often and they knew people so well that they were also caught up in the story itself. Mm-hmm. And they became attached to elements of it. So the purpose for which it was originally built wasn't met. But what we did find is it was so incredibly powerful as a problem-solving group that the Brain Trust actually became that. It is the problem-solving group. And we developed some principles, didn't emerge from day one, but we developed them over time to have it so that it was a powerful, ongoing group that continued to evolve. We had to do something else for the external force. And that something else was Steve Jobs.
What do you mean?
So here's what would happen. One of the rules of the Brain Trust is we have to keep power out of the room. We recognize that directors are often somewhat vulnerable, even if they're experienced, and especially if they're not experienced, because they're presenting ideas to fellow filmmakers whom they respect, and they know these ideas don't work.
I would be scared shitless, pardon my French, but I would be really nervous presenting to a group of my peers, you know, a new work of art that is not anywhere near done and getting their feedback. I would do it and I would love it, but I'd be really nervous.
Yes. And so they vary in their nervousness, but the truth is they all feel somewhat vulnerable. If you're a first-time director, you really feel vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You have to understand it, respect it. It's just true. We don't talk about it. But there are a couple things we do to address that. And one of them is you keep the power out of the room. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? There are a few basic rules. One of them is the Brain Trust itself doesn't have the right or the ability to override the director. Mm-hmm. So as a group, as members in the group, they can't say, here's what you should do. They can say, this is a serious problem. You need to address it.
Just to make it more real, give me an example from one movie of a problem.
Ratatouille, the original concept came from somebody else. It wasn't Brad Bird, wonderful man. He's the one that designed, the characters were designed, they had a basic structure, and the basic concept of what the movie was about came from this first person. So they're now trying to solve the problems of the movie. And they're going in circles with every screening, like they can't figure it out. I mean, as an example of a problem was that in the original versions, the chef, Gusteau, was alive, and he kind of gone down the path of letting his name be used to sell products. He kind of like, you know, something like selling his soul to make some money. And so then it leads to the question of, is this a redemption story? Mm. But getting back to what he was. But the other one was, is you got this character, the rat, Remy, who wants to become essentially a great artist. In this case, he's a great chef, but he wants to become a great artist. So is it about him becoming a great artist, or is it a redemption story? And there's another problem, and that is the rats don't talk to people. So you don't know what he's thinking. So if you don't know what he's thinking and he goes into this kitchen, then he goes back to the family, and he's got this extended family, and he tells them about what took place during the day, including what he thought about it. But from a movie point of view, this is a problem, because you just watched what he did. So if he's explaining what he just did, it brings the movie to a screeching halt. It's going around in cycles in order to solve this problem. You have a screening. The Brain Trust to look at it. They say, this is a problem. This isn't working. And they couldn't figure it out. Hmm. And ultimately, because they couldn't figure it out, we're in a situation where a rule is that because these things don't work, is we have to protect the director. And knowing that they have these serious problems, but there's one thing that a director can't do, is they can't lose the confidence of their crew. All right, because if something isn't working, you can't say it's not working, we're gonna get rid of you. And you just made everybody afraid, because then they're gonna wonder about it. So you have to say, we're going to always support you because we know it's hard and we know that it's not working and we know it's going to radically change. But if the people around them working on the problem have lost the confidence, then we have to do something. And we've, at this point, we've gone through a lot of stages to help and to support. We may have added people, but ultimately there is the one point you can't reach. So in this case, we reached it. We brought in Brad Bird.
So he replaced the existing director.
Yes. And he liked the concept of the movie. Another critical point is the director has to like the concept of the movie. Because that's the thing that carries them through. So
he worked. So is that one thing you're immediately looking for is the passion around a particular project before you greenlight a director?
Yes, we want to know, is this something where they're going to have enough strength and passion to go through the problems because everything's going to change? So since it's tough, these are hard problems, then what is it that it's going to take? I mean, there are a lot of traits you want in terms of leadership or creative abilities you have, but you also got to have that some internal support system to go through these tough problems.
So Brad takes over, then what?
So Brad has got, among his community of friends, a writer, and he sits down with his writer, and they come back and say, with a proposed solution. And the proposed solution is that the chef has just recently died. So immediately they solve that problem. It's Ratatouille's story about his growth as an artist. So it's no longer a redemption story for the chef. The other problem they solve is that because we know at the beginning that Remy really admires the chef, then he's a figment of his imagination and he knows he's a figment. Just like we talk to ourselves, we don't think we're crazy. We just think, we're talking to ourselves over something. So now he pops up and because he knows it's a figment of his imagination, then it feels perfectly natural. So now he can have these discussions about what he's thinking while he's down there on the floor. So now we have a natural way of letting us, the audience, know what he's thinking at the time. So just boom, solves two major problems in the movie. And then we go through all this. Of course, Brad is this brilliant writer. And when he got to the end, it's actually conceptually kind of what was pitched at the beginning, except that getting there was very, very hard.
Is it like that on every movie where it just changes course so many times that there's no way you're really going to predict that in the very beginning?
Yeah, sometimes it's that you come up with an idea and you go through a lot of courses to convey what you wanted to get at the beginning. So that happens sometimes. Sometimes the final movie actually has very little resemblance to what you start off with. And, the truth is, I don't care. None of us care.
And then going back to the brain trust, how has it, what is the purpose of it or what was it when you left?
The rules were one, as I mentioned, is keep the power out of the room. Now, the truth is, there were some people in the room who did have power or they had such a great reputation or they're so articulate that they had that kind of power. So in that case, of which there may be two or three that fell into that category, they were supposed to shut the hell up for the first 10 to 15 minutes. Because if they talk first, they would then be setting the tone for the meeting. But if they enter the discussion, then they're entering as colleagues. Now, the interesting thing about Steve is Steve had such a powerful personality that it wouldn't have mattered when he entered the discussion. All right. He was such a powerful, articulate force that it would have altered the meeting. And Steve knew that. So I asked Steve to never come to a brain trust meeting and he never came. And all this was to get the dynamics of the room right. We would bring some people in when they're fairly new on the creative side. Yeah, and it in the well, it's actually important all the way along. So right at the beginning when it's really rough, you know, they're helping solve the major structural problems. And then you get to the middle where, first of all, a new problem might arise that is pretty tricky, and but you've also set some things in place. Also, sometimes an idea might feel like it's great, and then you fall into the problem of is this great idea is actually distorting what you're doing, and you've invested in it. So it becomes more difficult to say, no, actually, this is getting in the way of solving the problems, and you need to throw it away. So, and then at the end, when you're trying to go to this, this can get you to a B-level film, but you want to get to A, then you have to do some subtle things. And then you've got a different kind of problem solving, same group of people, but you're at different phases. And you have to know what the phases are because you're adapting your notes for where you are. And our measure of success was, is whether or not people were really, truly focused on the problem. Sure. So in general, this brain trust process worked very well. Sometimes it went off the rails because of power or ego or stuff like that. That would happen. Not very often, but it does happen. And once in a while, it would go into a state of magic.
Yeah.
Ego really had left the room and everybody was focused on the problem and they weren't really attached to their ideas. They might work, they may not work, but they didn't feel deflated if an idea wasn't accepted or puffed up because it was, because that wasn't what it was about. Mm-hmm. When you reach that state, it's actually pretty magical.
Yeah, and I would think that this could be used and should be used in so many different organizations. I just heard two great examples on this podcast. You know, one is a startup founder who's a lawyer by training, and he craves intense, honest debates and people questioning his own assumptions, kind of like Steve Jobs. And then a professor at Harvard Business School named Amy Edmondson, and she coined the term psychological safety. And she said that her classroom, when she teaches, is a safe space. But it's not meant to be easy or comfortable. You know, the goal is to really get to the truth. And sometimes that's not an easy road. So, I mean, doesn't this brain trust concept and tool make sense at a lot of different companies, especially ones that really crave creativity and innovation?
Yeah, and I know Amy, and that's it's one of the principles that applies everywhere is since you're when you're doing something that's hard or new, that I mean, in my mind, if you're solving a problem, that's what requires creativity. I think creativity is a fairly broad concept as it's solving problems. And for me, the questions are, okay, great. I like the idea of solving problems. Why wouldn't you do that? And it turns out there are reasons. There are a lot of reasons why people don't do it. And the messaging and the signals that are given at different levels very frequently get in the way. So if you've got intensity can be misinterpreted. And in Steve's case, because he was intense, what he did was he surrounded himself with people who understood the intensity and they could push back. There are some people who actually find it hard to operate in an environment of intensity. And so the question is, how do you actually, because they might be actually really great people, mm-hmm. but how do you have them to be comfortable mm-hmm. in a situation where you're trying to get at the truth? And it's not hard. But usually the barriers come from the leadership, it comes mm-hmm. from the top down.
And what do you mean? And what can a leader do to remove some of those barriers?
One of my favorite examples is, because I know this happens a lot, is that if you've got a meeting and the leader in the meeting learns in the meeting about a problem, the response is often, why didn't I know about this ahead of time? They almost feel like they were disrespected because they weren't given the courtesy of being told about the problem ahead of time. So it doesn't take much to let everybody in that room know that this person should have known first. So you just set it up so that people are now planning around not surprising you in meetings. Okay, so you have pre-meetings. So this is a consequence of this signal that was given. It may not have been a loud signal, but it's a signal given about, I should have known first. Well, can't get stuff done if everybody's worrying about the order in which people have to know things. So, okay, does that happen in companies? Are there pre-meetings for meetings? The answer is yeah.
So that's one. So just being more cognizant of the signals that you're sending, and especially as a CEO or a top leader, is super important. And similarly, what about failure? You know, how do you get people to be comfortable with failure? I mean, even what is failure in your mind?
Failure has emotionally two different meanings. One of them, it's a very real one, is like, you know, you start off in school, and you can, if you fail a class, that's because you screwed up, you didn't work hard, or you aren't smart. Like, none of those are good meanings. In the real world, bridges fail and relationships fail. And in business and in politics, a failure is used as a bludgeon with which to beat opponents. The consequences of failure actually are very serious and very real. And so people know that. But at the same time, anybody would say, well, I learned a lot from my failures and I'm a better person for it, and it helped me make me who I am. So that's the educational meaning. The problem is we don't have the luxury of calling something educational until after it happens. And it's almost impossible for people to psychologically separate out these two different meanings. And so I realized that, well, I would say at Pixar that we have failures and we will use the word when it's appropriate. But in general, when we're working on a project, we don't use the terminology of failure very much. We would say, oh, we tried this and it doesn't work. So it's more like, it doesn't work. You could call, I tried this failure, but what it does is it gets screwed up with the wrong psychological meaning. So it isn't like, you know, I'm trying to change people's psychology because we can't do that. It's more that, okay, let's use a terminology that's a safer one, because really it is about trying something. And we are trying something. And that's the creative part. Let's try something new. Is it going to work? I don't know. If you get away the baggage that gets in the way from it, then that's part of it. You know, sometimes people will try something that's new. My view is that this was better articulated by one of the producers at Pixar, who wanted to try something new. And that's what it actually clicked in for me, was that she understood that she tried something new and it didn't work, she just fall back to what worked. Mm-hmm. So the actual cost of doing something risky is not as great as people think. Because if you say, I'm going to try something new, we just committed the entire film to that, then it's too high of a risk. But if you say, no, actually, we're going to try something new, and if it doesn't work, we'll fall back, then the cost is actually a small cost. So doing something new isn't zero cost, but it's not one of those things like, oh, we've done something disastrous. So I do think the way you think about trying something new is really important. And that's, don't overestimate the cost of something, because that's damaging. It keeps you from moving forward.
But so if you're a young rising star at Pixar or any organization, I mean, how far outside of your comfort zone should you venture? And just to play devil's advocate, won't an embarrassing failure be a permanent strike against you in most organizations, despite, you know, the softer rhetoric at the top?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, typically, if you've got somebody new to the company and they're working, you know, let's say on software, well, they're working with a group, and software engineers have a problem to solve and still come up with something new, but they're also interacting with each other. So it's not like I'm going to do something and I'm going to reveal this thing at the end and I haven't let anybody look at it while I'm working on it. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't do anything that way. So that's the whole point, is this new approach that we might take to making the film, that this the producer, it's Denise Rehm, that she used, was like, okay, we iterate on these films all the time, so we're constantly checking in. Mm-hmm. And if the check-in doesn't work, so that can be anything, it could be with the story, with the technology, with the process that we've got. That's what iteration is. Mm-hmm. Is this working? If not, what do we do to fix it? Or do we go back even further to go down a different path? But likewise, if you're producing a product for customers, do you go and do this thing and then magically at the end it appears, only to find that it's way off the mark? And the answer for some companies is, yeah, I'm going to wait till the very end, which is not actually including or valuing the users. And it was actually a thing I learned early on, is like, if you really value the people who are going to use what you're doing, then they become co-creators. Mm-hmm. Do you think of them as co-creators? Which means you include them, you may include partners in the process. So now when you iterate, you're iterating with the knowledge, because at the beginning, both parties may not know the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, if we're writing software for animators, well, the software people aren't animators, and the animators aren't software people. So if you say what it is that we're doing, you can specify it, and then you get to that point. If you build what you originally asked for, then the animators will say, oh, actually, that isn't quite what I meant. Okay. You know, or on the other side is like, honey, you built this thing, but it's just wrong. It's, you know, just all these things happen, but the way you do it is to value the other people along the way. Mm-hmm.
So let's wrap up just with a fun lightning round. And okay. What I'll do is I'll give you a name. You tell me what words immediately come to mind when I mention these iconic leaders. What about George Lucas?
George was the first, for several years, the only person with credibility in the film industry who thought that computers would make a difference. So that vision that he had is actually what got things going for me. And that's an unusual thing that he had.
What about Bob Iger?
Bob has these incredible instincts and an incredible ethic. When I say the instincts, is the first time he came to Pixar to see what we're doing, is he walked up the entranceway to our company, and he came alone, no entourage, just to meet with people.
So cool. In Emeryville?
Yes, we were in Emeryville. And as I say, that's not the instinct for a lot of executives, but for me, like, wow, it was very powerful.
Amazing. What about Brad Bird?
Brad is, I say, one of the most brilliant writers I've seen. Incredibly passionate about story and filmmaking, and also really good eyes for animation. It's actually astonishing what you can see.
What about Remy the rat in Ratatouille?
Well, actually, Remy represents, and the movie represents, Brad's feelings about art and passion. It is the expression of him.
I love it. Ed Catmull, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much to our audience around the world for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, or want to attend private conversations and events, feel free to visit us at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we hope you'll join us next week.